Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the Free Syrian Army, which appears to have been driven out of parts of Aleppo. Robert Baer, a veteran CIA officer who operated in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, joins us to discuss the disarray amongst opposition fighters and, since Saudi Arabia is taking the lead in arming and equipping the insurgency, not surprisingly, there is a growing influx of Wahhabis into the battle to topple the Assad regime, and they will influence and shape Syria's future. Then we will speak with a veteran of the United States Senate who works for Senators Gaylord Nelson, Abe Ribicoff, Thomas Eagleton, Robert Byrd, and Jay Rockefeller. Ira Shapiro, the author of a new book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, joins us to speak about a time when the Senate worked for the American people before it fell into the grip of gridlock. We will discuss how the poisonous partisanship and the purging of moderates by the Tea Party can be stopped. Then finally, we'll examine a newly released study in the journal Nature titled Demand for Water Outstrips Supply. Emily Wirth, the Water Program Director at Food and Water Watch, joins us to discuss the extraordinary amounts of water being used by oil and gas companies that ends up polluted by the growing practice of fracking, hydraulic fracturing. We'll also look into the contamination of increasingly depleted aquifers from fracking. Joining us now is Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
It's good to be back.
And it looks as though the Syrian opposition has taken a beating in Aleppo. In fact, the BBC reporting that some of the fighters are dropping their weapons and just running away. We keep hearing in our press about the growing presence of al-Qaeda. But that's, I think, is misleading, isn't it? I mean, it would seem logical to me that if the Saudi Arabians are taking the lead in arming and equipping the insurgency, wouldn't that mean that they will have some influence, and wouldn't that mean that their fighters, the Wahhabis, are the ones that are coming in?
Well, it's complicated what's happening. And number one is they don't have enough weapons to resist the Syrian army. These are elite units that were sent up to Aleppo, primarily Alawite and Christian. They've got battlefield experience, modern weapons, and these guys just have Kalashnikovs. There was no way they could hold on to that neighborhood in Aleppo. The fact that they got up and left is a smart thing to do. This is a guerrilla war for it. It's not a war of position. The problem in Syria is the neglect from the outside is turning this into a war that's going to look very much like Iraq was in 2004 and 5 and 6, where you have disparate units, rebels, al-Qaeda. The name doesn't really matter. And a lot of the money that's going to be coming into the Syrians, I don't know how long it's going to continue or in what amounts, is going to be from private sources in the Gulf. So, and they will tend to be highly, Wahhabi, if you like, Muslim Brotherhood. It doesn't really matter at this point, you know. But I think it's a misnomer to call it al-Qaeda because that suggests an organization. It's more like the rat lines are sending money in a vacuum.
But is there there appears to be disarray, at least factionalism, within the Syrian opposition. That's been the case all along, and I imagine it extends to the Free Syrian Army. So I was just trying to get a sense of, because the Muslim Brotherhood, and I believe you're in contact with them, they are indigenous to Syria, and they've been around for some time, and Bashar Assad, al-Assad's father tried to squash them and effectively put them out of business for a while with the massacre in Hama. I thought that they were leading this opposition, but...
I think they're the backbone of it, but the point is they have no combat experience. They just don't know how to hold a city. They can do ambushes and blow things up and infiltrate Damascus, take over neighborhoods. But the moment the army concentrates its force, they don't stand a chance. What scares me about Syria, and by the way, I served there for a couple of years, is the chaos that's going to spread. Not so much these you know single victories either by the regime or the opposition. And normally, when chaos like that spreads, you have a Somalia-like situation where the most radical and the most violent and the ones that tend to use suicide bombing will become a major player in a conflict like this. And you're going to see people from all over the Gulf, Pakistan, and we've already seen from North Africa, flowing into Syria to fight a jihad. And you're right, the Free Syrian Army is not organized. There's no command structure. There's no radio communications to speak of, no training. And again, they're missing all sorts of weapons.
So what is exactly going on then with the Saudis there and the Gulf? They're taking the lead, as far as anyone knows, in arming and equipping the opposition. I believe the Qataris have put in a small force that was trained in Libya. And the CIA supposedly has some people on the ground. What puzzles me is the U.S. is taking a back seat. My understanding was that if the Saudis are leading it, they've got nothing but money. But you're suggesting that no serious weaponry is getting in there, no serious training, and no serious military opposition.
No, it's all light weapons. The Saudis, their history in this sort of thing isn't very good. You know, they supported the Afghans in the 80s, the Mujahideen. You know, 95% of that money was stolen. It only got to the Afghans when it was run through Pakistan. It was organized. They set up logistics, and they kept track of the weapons. Right now, it's not organized enough. The Qataris do not have any people on the ground in Syria, and neither the Saudis. They don't know how to fight this kind of war. They can sit on the border, send in bandages, send in ammunition. They don't have enough ammunition. And you know, it's just these people are sort of fighting on their own. I mean, and I'm not taking sides on this at all. Trust me. You know, decapitating this regime is not going to add to the stability in that part of the world. I'm just describing the situation on the ground.
Well, there's a. You've been involved, though, in the UN inquiry into the death of Hariri, and that was pretty clear that that the Syrians were the intellectual authors, and perhaps Hezbollah were the executors of the operation. Isn't it pretty clear that the Assad's, even the son, the accidental heir to this regime, the current leader Bashar, that they've played a pretty effective hand for essentially weak country. Bush and Chirac got together and thought that they could put them out of business. And the regime was opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood, at one point they allowed Al Qaeda to come in and transit into Iraq to hurt the Americans after they thought they could squeeze him. I believe Colin Powell went there and tried to intimidate the regime. Sarkozy, more recently, tried to woo them back away from Iran, and he got completely taken by them. Is that your assessment of them?
The problem is Washington tends to forget lessons, and one lesson they forgot is the Syrian army doesn't exist as an army that we would know. Each and every unit, I don't care if you have a Sunni colonel and a Sunni deputy commander of a battalion, at some point there'll be an Alawite that controls the unit. You can't deploy a tank, you can't send up an airplane with an Alawite not approving it, whatever rank he is. Now, the units that are fighting are largely Alawite units. You can be certain of that. Their loyalty is 100%. They feel they have the back to the wall. The rest of the army, and there's about 8 divisions that haven't moved out of barracks, are just sitting there, and they're not allowed to move out. They would be immediately crushed by the Air Force, and that's being watched. So what they're hoping is, let's say that you have 10% of the country is active opposition in the field fighting or doing something. Then you have another 20% of the country, or this minority, and Christians as well, and some Kurds are fighting back. And it's a fairly even conflict in numbers, but again, it's the training and the weapons that the opposition's missing.
So what is leading people like Hillary Clinton, who's on many occasions say that Assad's days are numbers? King Abdullah of Jordan recently said that he thought that that the Alawites and the Assads would end up in a kind of redoubt in the mountains along the northern coast of Syria. What leads them to the assumption that the Assads and the Alawites are finished?
They're reading the Washington Post and the New York Times. They're just getting a sense of the analysis. And I don't mean that in a critical way. The fact is that there's no U.S. officials in Syria. There's a lot of foreigners going in. I know SAS is in there. I just talked to them today, some guys. But there's no real, coverage of the entire country because it's so disparate. And they see the battles go back and forth, and the conclusion is, well, how can the regime last that much longer, especially with the sanctions? They're out of money, and they're out of refined fuel. They should be out of ammunition pretty soon. How can they keep on going on? So they're like a lot of us, and they're making a guess. But it's a lot of these questions are just unknowable.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. So the Iranians are hosting a meeting, I guess, they got 29 countries showing up, although the Russians have only sent an ambassador, not their foreign minister. China, Iraq, Pakistan, Jordan, and India are apparently sending some kind of delegations. The Iranian official who's presiding over this meeting suggests that Iran they've called for a dialogue between the government and the opposition. My question would be, is this a sort of desperate attempt to stay relevant, or is there any way in the world that nobody else so far, including the Russians and the United Nations, have been able to come up with any kind of peace plan? What's going on with the Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Saleh saying that he's going to preside over a dialogue between both sides?
Well, you have to keep in mind that if the Sunni Arabs, for Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, all these emirates, this is real. Syria is really a war about Iraq. The way they look at it is they lost Iraq to Iran in 2003. And the way to punish the Iranians and, change the balance back is to overthrow the Alawites, who are over Shia Muslims. And it's their cousins, the Shia Muslims. Overthrow them, and then the balance is back. And that would also lead to probably a change in Lebanon, where Hezbollah wouldn't have the same power. So what we're seeing there is a proxy war. And I don't think the Iranians are going to let this go easily, because if they let Syria go, there goes Lebanon. And their entire foreign policy since the beginning of the revolution was an Islamic revolution in Lebanon. That's sort of the raison d'etre when it comes to foreign policy. And if they lose that, it's a huge setback for them. And the way the Saudis are looking at it is, hey, you guys are going to play with the international community on this, with the nuclear weapons. We don't know if you have them, but you're about ready to get them. That's going to unbalance things, but watch what we do in Syria and later Lebanon. So it's a bigger conflict, but it's also a conflict that makes it more dangerous. And I think everybody in the West, Russia, and China wish that the violence would just stop, because no one is going to benefit from another 2 or 3 years of this. And I think Washington would love for somebody to step in, even the Russians, and put an end to this. We are not against Bashar al-Assad. We're only against him in the sense that he's allied with Iran, and Iran's heading toward a nuclear weapon. You know, there's just so many factors in this. And again, I'll go back and say this makes it much more dangerous in a place like Libya, which is sort of out of the way, insignificant army, and doesn't sit right on the Arab Peninsula.
Well, I could understand, and I understand that the Saudis were furious with the Bush administration for taking down Saddam Hussein and making Iran stronger and essentially turning Iraq over to the, under Iranian influence and thus completing this Shia crescent through Iraq into Syria and into Lebanon. But what? How do you explain then, if the stakes are that high, if it's a proxy war, why then are the Saudis so incompetent, and why aren't they? You're saying that they that these fighters are under equipped, under supplied, under manned, under armed, and with no guidance. So if the stakes are that high, and if they want to reverse Iranian influence and strike a blow against Tehran, why these half measures with the Free Syrian Army?
I think even the Saudis are scared about where this is going to go. I mean, it's very simple. You know, you and I tomorrow could fly to Libya and buy surface-to-air missiles that work and send them to Syria. I mean, I'm speaking hypothetically, of course. But no one's doing that, probably because the Turks won't let them in. You can't get them in through Lebanon. And people have even taken sides in this conflict are worried that it could get very, very bad and completely out of control. So I think the Saudis have a moral obligation to support the Syrian opposition, but they're certainly not going to go to war over this. I mean, you know, in a serious way of sending surrogates or hiring mercenaries to go into Syria, or nor will the Turks set up a, you know, rear bases where any sort of decent training went on or communications. Because they've been worried about the Kurds. You know, there's a lot of Kurds in Syria, and what happens if there's a Kurdish state that hooked up with the Iraqi Kurds? It would be a nightmare for them.
So that's what you're saying, Robert Baer, that you know, the U.S. and everybody would just wish this thing to end, because nobody knows how it's going to end, and nobody seems to know what to do to either stop it or make, you know, finally find a way to decisively get rid of this regime. So what is the...
Absolutely, and don't, you know, we don't need to blame anybody on this. The Arab Spring started probably when the Syrians killed Hariri in 2005. That was the first demonstrations to force any dictatorship to do anything. It just happened. But now that it's happened, I think it's everybody's interest to contain it. Because remember, the Saudis hate the Muslim Brotherhood. They are competition to the Wahhabi clerisy. So they don't necessarily want to see a strong Sunni Islamic state in Syria, one that they don't have any influence over. And just like they don't want one in Egypt. There's so many complicated pieces in this, it's really hard to follow.
Well, but there's also this, I think, at the core of the Arab Spring, surely, there is this youthful uprising against these crooked kleptocrats and thugs and murderers that have stolen their future. I mean, you know...
It's demographic, it's environmental, it's short of water. You've got, you know, Syrian youth unemployment was hitting about 50% before this started, or at least that's one statistic. We don't know for sure. So there's so many factors going into this, and these regimes are just terribly corrupt.
And ruthless, too. I mean, just...
They're totally ruthless. They're absolutely ruthless. And his kid, Bashar al-Assad, will flatten the city, as we've seen in Aleppo, like his father flattened Hama. I was there after it was flattened. And I mean, there wasn't anything standing. It was a parking lot.
So what do you make of the arrest by Lebanese authorities today of a former minister?
Michel Samaha?
Yeah, Samaha.
He's a friend of mine.
Oh, really? So he had close ties with Assad, did he not?
Oh, he was a SOB, frankly, to put it nicely. He was very close to Hassan Nasrallah. He was very close to Bashar al-Assad. The prosecutor, in a very bizarre charge, I believe, is accusing him of murder and assassination. I spent years and years and years in Lebanon, and I'm probably as ignorant as when I started, because there's so many hidden motivations why they would take a pro-Syrian government would take a former pro-Syrian minister and put him in jail. And I've heard all sorts of crazy things, like this is a setup and they're going to let him out, he's going to come out a hero, but, you know, it's really too complicated to follow, at least in my understanding.
But surely already there's a spillover with refugees into Lebanon, and my understanding is that Nasrallah and the Hezbollah have lost a lot of their luster with the Lebanese.
There's a fight inside Hezbollah. The military wing is fighting Nasrallah, and it's unclear, and there's all sorts of people in Hezbollah that have disappeared. I don't know if they've gone home or they've gone south or they're on vacation, but it's all very odd, and the rumors in Beirut are flying today. And then, of course, we've got the whole problem of the 70,000 rockets, which are all trained on Israel. And, you know...
But the fishes in Hezbollah would be over the fact that the Lebanese people are in solidarity with the victims of the Assads, and Hezbollah is clearly on the wrong side of that argument.
Well, Hezbollah started as a populist party. Now it's taking the side of a dictator for no apparent reason. So its whole existence is being called into question. Are they just another Arab dictatorship, or are they with the people, so to speak? Or is it purely sectarian? Are they just Shia and they support the regime in Damascus because they're Shia? In these divisions, you've got to understand the sectarian divisions really drive everything in this part of the world.
And that that at the end of the day, this core group of Alawites that you say are the core of the army, the core of the fighting divisions that are driving the rebels out, the majority of the country, even though they're ill-armed and badly organized, they're still, 70% of the country we're talking about. I suppose that's what leads people like Hillary Clinton to assume that at the end of the day, Assad's days are numbered, just on the basis.
Yeah, but that's, anybody that predicts what's going to happen in the Middle East, probably turns out to be wrong. I've certainly been wrong enough. And to tell you what's going to happen tomorrow in Syria, I don't know. But the smart people, I still talk to the regime as well, to Alawites, and they tell me, first of all, they told me 2 weeks ago, we will retake Aleppo, period. And then they said, this is going to go on for a long, long time, this conflict.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about a time when the United States Senate actually did the people's business.
I know what you want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ira Shapiro, an international trade lawyer in Washington, D.C., who spent 12 years working in senior positions in the United States Senate, playing important roles in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and completing the Metro Rail system. During the Clinton administration, he served as a leading U.S. trade negotiator, ultimately earning the rank of ambassador. His new book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira Shapiro.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And your book begins with Evan Bayh, the senator from Indiana, who recently quit, saying there's too much partisanship and not enough progress in the United States Senate. And then more recently, of course, Senator Richard Lugar, highly regarded moderate senator from Indiana, was defeated in the primary by a Tea Party candidate. So it feels like that's a 1-2 punch, isn't it, Ira?
Well, yes, it is, Ian, and it's a continuation of the downward spiral that has marked the Senate for about 20 years. I call it the hyper-partisan Senate, and it's almost unrecognizable to those of us who grew up with the Senate of the 60s and the 70s, which is the Senate I write about, the Senate of Mike Mansfield and Ted Kennedy, Jacob Javits, Howard Baker, Robert Dole. These were people who were identifiably Democrats or Republicans, but they were basically national figures who found a way to work together without partisan considerations. And we've lost that, and Murdoch's election over Lugar was a good example of it. Murdoch said when he ran, "The problem is the Republicans in Washington are compromising too much." He noticed something that nobody else has noticed.
Well, it is a pretty sad state of affairs when another moderate senator on the Republican side, Kay Bailey Hutchison, has just been replaced in Texas by another Tea Party ideologue who again feels that his mission in Washington is to essentially shut down the Senate, to block, not to compromise. This is the new mantra that we're hearing on the stump out there in this election year from the Tea Party. And frankly, it's a very troubling and rather strange throwback in many ways to totalitarianism, where the object of radical groups like the communists or the Nazis, for example, in hijacking the political process is to create gridlock, to bring the government down. Now, I'm not suggesting the Tea Party is in any way comparable to the communists and the Nazis, but the tactic is similar.
Well, I think that I'm hopeful that the election will also produce some people who recognize that you don't accomplish things in politics without an ability to compromise. If you look at Angus King, who's an independent running in Maine, or Heather Wilson, who is a moderate Republican trying to run in New Mexico, you can see people who have had accomplishments, either as governor in King's case or legislatively in Wilson's case, but people who know how potentially to be senators. I sort of adhere to Alan Simpson's view. Former Senator Simpson recently said, if you don't know how to compromise, you ought to find another line of work because politics demands it. The people that know in both parties, the people that know how politics demand compromise and how the government works have to overcome these Tea Party people and Jim DeMint from South Carolina and people like that. And unfortunately, they haven't been doing it enough. The Republicans have been too solidly unified against Barack Obama to do anything in a less than partisan way.
Well, their leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, after the 2010 elections, vowed that his number one priority was to get rid of Barack Obama. And it's worth noting that one of the Tea Party senators has just been given a slot at the Republican convention to speak, Rand Paul, the new senator from Kentucky.
I agree with you. I find Senator McConnell to be a very effective Republican leader, but not a Senate leader of the sort that we used to have. Senate leaders understood that, in John McCain's old words, it's country first. You're not just there as a partisan. When Barack Obama became president and came into office at a time of absolute national economic crisis, he was entitled to expect some cooperation from the Republican minority. Presumably, we come together in times of crisis. And thanks to Mitch McConnell, we didn't.
Again, I'm speaking with Ira Shapiro, who spent 12 years working in senior positions in the United States Senate. His new book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. And you worked in those 12 years in the United States Senate, Ira Shapiro, with for Senators Gaylord Nelson, Abraham Ribicoff, Thomas Eagleton, Robert Byrd, and Jay Rockefeller. I recall, well, a year or so before his death, Teddy Kennedy gave an interview to NPR where he was asked about, since Teddy Kennedy had a pretty long tenure in the U.S. Senate, he was asked about what changes he had noticed over the years and what was the most profound change in the United States Senate. And without missing a beat, Teddy Kennedy said money. He said, you know, we used to work in the U.S. Senate. We used to show up on Monday and leave on Friday. He said, now, because of the need to raise money, we basically show up on Tuesday night, work Wednesday and Thursday, and then are off for the next few days over the weekend campaigning for money. So it's not, money has apparently created a system where the senators are basically supplicants to wealthy donors, and they're not doing the people's business.
Well, I think the money, the spiral of money by which senators are now looking to raise $15, $20, $30 million for their race, I think it's a terribly corrupting situation. And it also, even if one were to say that since they're vacuuming up money wherever they can, it's not corruption, it is in fact taking a huge amount of the time they used to spend together as legislators. So Ted Kennedy is absolutely right about that. I would couple with that, though, a conscious strategy that has been followed by recent Republican leaders to essentially lead the minority in a party line way, a hyper-partisan way, rather than come up with the kind of cooperation and principled compromise in the national interest that characterized the Senate when it worked. Ted Kennedy is a good example, of course. He was a great senator. Somehow managed to combine very strong convictions with an ability to compromise and to be tolerant of other people's views. We don't see that enough today.
Well, didn't he forge a very close friendship with Orrin Hatch, the conservative senator from Utah?
No, he did. He did. Orrin Hatch started out as, you know, the apostle of the new right of the late 1970s. But over time, he became a legislator who was able to do things with Senator Kennedy and others.
Well, in your book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, Ira Shapiro, you talk about how much work was done. The 1978 debate over the United States officially recognizing the People's Republic of China while keeping its pledge to Taiwan, that is described along with the Senate saving New York City from bankruptcy, establishing a relationship with China, which I just mentioned, and the Panama Canal Treaty, and government oversight with the establishment of the inspector generals in every federal agency, and of course the Senate debated the Camp David deal between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. And it seemed as though they also, in their role of oversight in terms of nominations, nominees got judged on their merits irrespective of partisan politics. So we have a situation now, of course, where Mitt Romney is running for president. And who has he chosen for his person in charge of his judicial appointments, if he's to become president.
Right, none bringing us back to Robert Bork in 1987,
exactly.
That confirmation fight.
Right.
No, I think, Ian, I think you're exactly right. And I was going to say that one of the things the book lays out in the narrative, a series of really major issues that the Senate stepped up to one after another and did things like the Panama Canal treaties, where people really took personal political risks to do things that were right for the country. Howard Baker, the Republican leader then, wanted to run for president, and his staff said, "Senator, you can never run for president in the Republican part, not get the Republican nomination if you support these treaties." And yet he supported the treaties. He took the lead on them, because they were in the national interest. And you saw people, one after another, stepping forward and doing things because that's what they were there for. They weren't there to obstruct, and they weren't there to paralyze the body. And right now, the term that often gets used that we've all heard is the permanent campaign. It used to be campaigns stopped, and people then started governing and making the deals needed to get things done. Now, the campaign never ends, and so there's just positioning for the next election.
Well, you mentioned, Ira Shapiro, obstruct, which, of course, leads one to ask about the filibuster, and, of course, our notion of the filibuster comes from the classic movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But somehow or other, the Senate's managed to come up with a painless filibuster where they don't actually have to speak for hours on end, where they all have to do is sort of indicate that they don't want cloture. I mean, it's an amazingly easy mechanism, and of course it's been used essentially constantly. So it's made the government by the majority meaningless.
No, that's right. We used to have the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington type filibusters. Filibusters were relatively rare. They were serious, and people actually had to get on the Senate floor, hold the Senate floor, and demonstrate how strong their opposition to it was. Now we have a situation where people just sort of, as you've indicated, they basically threaten to withhold their support and withhold unanimous consent and threaten to filibuster. And they use the calendar in a way as an ally, so if they just register an objection, the majority leader feels the need to go on to the next piece of work. I think that they should have been challenged on these things. I think the Republicans should have been required. If they wanted a filibuster, they should hold the floor, and they should have their feet put to the fire.
So what explains that? I mean, what's wrong with Harry Reid? I don't understand why, because, you know, it basically led to gridlock. I mean, you've got a very partisan Republican House, and you've got Mitch McConnell vowing to bring down the president. So why not at least have one of the legislative branches function?
Well, I think that he basically has found a situation where there's too much on the agenda, and he's trying to find things that he can move ahead on and not bog the Senate down endlessly. But from my standpoint, the Senate rules are being used and abused in a way that, A, they ought to be changed, but B, until they're changed, people ought to be forced, to take action and hold the floor if they want to filibuster things. So I don't agree with the way he's handled it.
So what is your sense then of what will happen or what is needed to happen to, because to some extent in your book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in the Time of Crisis, you sort of say the fault is not with the Senate, but in the country itself.
Well, not entirely. I think, I'm not sure I said that.
Sorry.
Well, a lot of the politics of the country have changed somewhat, but I still believe that it's incumbent on the senators to rise above the vitriolic political culture. They're being sent to Washington, most of them, not all of them, but most of them are being sent to Washington to try to reconcile our differences, not just reflect them or inflame them.
Well, I suppose, though, what has changed in the period when you're in the Senate and when and what you've written about, the last great Senate, that since then there's been increase in voter apathy. Cable news with this 24-hour cycle where constant process stories are churned out, examining the small print of trivial issues on a daily basis. And then you've got, what we talked about earlier with Teddy Kennedy, the extraordinary influx of money, and now with Citizens United, unlimited money.
Yeah.
And then the other factor, I guess, is the Karl Rove types, these political consultants and people like Grover Norquist, who in many ways appear to be more powerful than the senators. I mean, he's certainly got a lot of them intimidated.
No question. And there's no question that everything, almost everything, has changed since the era that I wrote about in the 60s and the 70s. And it's much easier to be pessimistic than optimistic because of those changes. But that's one of the reasons I put it really back on the senators to rise above this, because I don't think the country can wait until we fix the campaign financing problem or wait for the 24-hour media to change. I think if you go back to, let's think about recently, if you went back to the beginning of 2009, if the Republicans had reached back when Barack Obama reached out to them, I think we would have had a stronger and earlier economic recovery. I think we would have had some recognition, or could have had some recognition, that the health care legislation really reflects both Democratic and Republican ideas. So I think there are a lot of things that I put on the senators and the Senate. We can't wait for the political culture to change itself totally.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ira Shapiro, and for sharing your book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in a Time of Crisis.
Well, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Ira Shapiro, an international trade lawyer in Washington, D.C., who spent 12 years working in senior positions in the United States Senate, playing important roles in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and completing the Metro Rail system. During the Clinton administration, he served as a leading U.S. trade negotiator, ultimately earning the rank of ambassador. His new book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about a report in the journal Nature that says the demand for water outstrips supply globally.
Bruce Rother!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
The sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand. No, just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand. No, just won't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Emily Wirth, the Food and Water Watch Water Program Director. She conducts research and promotes policies at the local, state, and federal level to help protect the nation's water systems as public assets and to safeguard the country's water resources. Welcome to Background Briefing, Emily Wirth.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the journal Nature have just released a study titled Demand for Water Outstrips Supply. And I've been speaking to some authors and environmentalists about the issues, for example, of the Canadian tar sands. where, and I spoke to some Canadian environmentalists about this, where they were pointing out that in order to extract the tar or the oil from the sand, they use enormous amounts of high-pressure heated water, and it ends up in these vast pools. And some of these environmentalists were asking rhetorically that at some point in our future, maybe water is going to be more valuable than oil, and we're wasting all of this water that becomes polluted, and it's filling up these vast lakes up there that Bill McKibben describes as it looks like Mordor. So now we've got this report from Nature. It's starting to, it sounds like there's a lot more consciousness of this notion that oil that we think is so valuable, which we're going to great lengths to extract, and using enormous amounts of water to do so, maybe at the end of the day we're going to rue what we're doing.
Yes, I mean, I think this is a really, should be a wake-up call for a lot of people. The study just found that we are simply over-exploiting our groundwater resources in many of the large aquifers around the world. We're exploiting them and extracting water at a much quicker pace than it's being replenished. And this study is really important in measuring exactly what this, they call it the groundwater footprint, is, and in pointing out that currently this footprint that includes both human use and what's needed to maintain our ecological systems is currently about 3.5 times the actual area of what, of the water that we have in our aquifers. And so I think this is an important wake-up call and a time for us to really examine some of the practices, including the really extreme energy extraction that's being used by the oil and gas industry, that's not only really water-intensive but also presents a number of problems with water quality, and also removes water from the hydrological cycle and is likely contributing to this over-extraction of our groundwater resources.
So we're not talking just about the Canadian tar sands where water is used and spoiled forever, vast amounts of it in stored in these lakes, but I take it you're referring to fracking, the process of fracking.
Exactly. With drilling and fracking for oil and gas has been something that's been rapidly expanding over the past decade in the United States as these new technologies have been developed that allow for access to oil and gas resources that were previously not accessible. But something that that we know about this industry is that it uses millions of gallons of water to drill and frack each well. And we're drilling and fracking hundreds of new wells a year just in certain states alone. And so these millions of gallons of water that are used for each of these wells really add up. And another thing is that the water, the industry combines this the water with sand and a mixture of different chemicals and injects it at high pressure underground to break apart rock to allow oil or gas to flow to the surface into the well. And anywhere between 25% and 75% of that, you know, it's mostly water, it's millions of gallons of water that's injected along with these chemicals, returns to the surface. And then it's what the industry calls produced water, but it's really contaminated water. And so each year in the United States alone, there's 2.4 trillion gallons of this produced water generated now from oil and gas operations. And that's part of, that's added to the 5.7 trillion gallons produced around the world. So a total of 8.1 trillion gallons now of this polluted water is being produced every day. And that's enough to cover the entire United States 3 feet deep every year. And that volume is only expected to increase at a rate of about 8%. And this is industry's own data that we saw from a conference that was attended earlier this year. And so this is a serious strain that's being put on our really more and more precious water resources. And, you know, we need to start changing the decisions that we're making about the use of water as it becomes something that we really need to safeguard.
Again, I'm speaking with Emily Wirth, the Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. She conducts research and promotes policies at the local, state and federal level to help protect the nation's water systems as public assets and to safeguard the country's water resources. So this extraordinary amount of water that's being used in fracking, and fracking, of course, is increasing exponentially, is there any way to reclaim it? Is it terminally polluted, in other words?
Well, there's a lot of research that needs to be done on this. The industry is making claims about that they'll reuse or recycle the water. And there's actually a lot of energy being put into developing systems to treat this water by the private water industry, private companies that are looking to generate profit from both selling fresh water to the oil and gas industry and also to develop very, expensive and energy-intensive treatment facilities that they would build to treat this wastewater. And so it's hard to say if the science is there to properly treat this. There's a lot of companies across the world now who have a very keen interest in pursuing this as a profit-generating exercise. And so this is part of this problem, is that as water becomes more scarce, many corporations are seeing this as a profit-generating resource, and there's more and more interest in water as a commodity and as a as something to be invested in as a source of future profit. And for us at Food and Water Watch, we find that to be a very concerning trend. We see water as a basic human right and a public resource that we should manage as wisely as we can for future generations.
Well, I remember speaking, Emily Wirth, with Josh Fox, who made the original film about fracking, and I think in many ways brought the very practice of fracking to public attention for the first time. He attempted to film a public hearing in the Congress, at a U.S. Congressional Committee hearing, and he was kicked out. And the hearing was over. The Environmental Protection Agency were being castigated by Republican senators who were clearly funded by the oil companies, who were trying to discredit a study that they'd made, I believe, in Wyoming or maybe it was Montana, about how fracking had contaminated groundwater. So what you've talked about how enormous quantities of water are used in the fracking process, and then this water is polluted, and you gave a figure of it being able to cover the entire United States for several feet. So just I'm trying to get my head around that. But the other issue surely must be that if you're injecting all of this water and with various chemicals in it, near the water table, what's the likelihood of the kind of contamination that the EPA has found in Montana?
Well, the industry claims the contrary, but there are various studies that have pointed to contamination of underground sources of drinking water. There's a 1987 EPA report that found that fracking fluid had contaminated a water well in West Virginia, and that's one. There's also a study that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that found that methane concentrations near active gas areas were 17 times higher than those that were in non-active areas. And this is possibly due to an issue that Josh Fox has pointed to again more recently, which has to do with leaking well casings. And then again, the U.S. EPA released a report in December of 2011 that concluded that likely the impact of groundwater in Pavilion, Wyoming can be explained by hydraulic fracturing. And there was another study that came out this year, two studies, one by Myers in a peer-reviewed journal called Groundwater, and another in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that have highlighted that the question is not if fracking will contaminate underground aquifers, but where it will happen next and when. And the research is showing that well casings fail and that fracking fluid that's injected underground stays there indefinitely, and it's not known where it's going to go and how it can end up encountering water underground through natural pathways. And so this is very concerning and something that is, we believe at Food and Water Watch, an issue that that needs to be addressed right away. We're calling for a nationwide ban on hydrofracking, and we think that now is the time to move on to a renewable energy future, and we should not be going to these desperate measures to extract the last remaining fossil fuels. And now is the time that our decision makers should really move on to the next generation of energy.
Well, just in closing, Emily Worth, the journal Nature's report that was just released, demands for water outstrip supply, it's a global problem. Obviously,
yes.
We talked a lot about the waste the, and pollution of water. Vast quantities are using to extract the last bits of gas out of shale and oil, etc. We talked about the Canadian tar sands. Again, we're going to desperate measures now to get the last drops of oil. I spoke recently with a specialist on the Indian power grid when it crashed recently, and she told me that, so much of it's bootlegged in the rural areas, but the main use of electricity in the rural areas is to drive pumps to extract groundwater, and she said that the depletion of the water table in rural India is an even greater crisis than the power crisis.
Wow.
So,
yeah,
you know,
I think it's...
There you have just, I'm saying I'm getting this stuff from different sources now, and it's starting to look like a pretty grim picture.
It is, and I think it's, it's time for change, and that more and more people around the world are starting to speak out about the problems, whether it's water, or there's been a real movement now growing around these concerns with fossil fuel from the Keystone Pipeline and the tar sands to this growing global movement of fracking. And actually at Food and Water Watch, we're gearing up for a global day of action against fracking, and we're calling it the Global Frackdown. And it's taking place on September 22nd in communities across the country where people who are speaking out against this this industry will be taking action in their communities at the same time. And you can find out more about that on foodandwaterwatch.org. So.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Emily Worth.
Oh, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Emily Worth, who's the Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. She conducts research and promotes policies at the local, state, and federal level to help protect the nation's water systems as public assets and to safeguard the country's water resources. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, or you can contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.